Welcome to PPM Simplifies. This is a weekly podcast that will help you have a better understanding on environmental regulations and how they relate to your industry. In each episode, we'll talk with experts across various industries who will share their insights with you. This is PPM Simplifies. Hello, this is Todd Perry, and welcome to PPM Simplifies. We have a great show lined up for you today. We've got Jared Satterfield, Monroe Office Manager, with us today. Good morning, Jared. How are you?
Morning, Todd. Doing well.
It is always good to have you in here. You are a resident expert on a lot of cool topics, and today we're going to do one that I think our audience will really enjoy. We're going to talk about remediation. We'll talk about a few different types of constituents that can get into the subsurface and different techniques of how to do that remediation. So, Jared, you ready to go, my friend?
Ready to go. Thank you for having me here, Todd.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I guess just start setting the stage, if you will. There's a couple of different types of contaminants we might see out there in the real world.
There is. And there's two main types. You have LNAPLs and DNAPLs. Better to kind of think about them as floaters and sinkers. The LNAPLs, they're a light non-aqueous phase liquid, and so they float on water. They're less dense. And so then you have the DNAPLs, which they're denser than water, and so they sink.
Right. So, some examples, and you're talking about lighter, gasoline would be a very common example there. But we think about something that's denser than water that would actually sink. What's a good example there?
So kind of a more common would be like a creosote wood treatment or dry cleaning solvents.
Now, as a bigger principle, Jared, as we think about, constituents that would sink, they're really going to begin to work through the subsurface until they encounter some type of restrictive layer?
That's right. A lot of times you'll have a restrictive layer of clay, a tighter clay that will cause it to stop the sinking in certain groundwater situations.
That's right. And, state that we live in, Louisiana, we typically have fairly high groundwater. So on, chemicals that will float, it doesn't take very long to get there. But on sinkers, they can really become very difficult to remediate.
Yeah, you run into a lot longer time periods on the sinkers versus the floaters. The floaters are a lot easier to assess and also a lot easier to remediate.
So with that said, would you further break down these chemicals into, how would you maybe identify them or how they behave in the subsurface?
So each set, the sinkers and the floaters, or the LNAPLs and DNAPLs, they have kind of the common constituent of concerns found in the subsurface, which you would sample for. Those break down with the LNAPLs. You have BTEX and TPHG, which is total petroleum, hydrocarbon, gasoline range. You then have a diesel range, an oil range. And then another common is PAHs, which are found with the diesel as well. DNAPLs, they're not quite as common, but they're still things that we have to look out for. I mean, you have the PCE and the dry cleaning solvents, the PCBs and like electrical transformer oils, and then creosote, of course.
And, as you operate, it could be something like a gas station. You refer to a dry cleaner. It could be a lumber processing manufacturing facility. There's lots of different facilities, automotive facilities. The list goes on and on to where you can have these different solvents and chemicals and their beneficial use at the site. But things happen. Oops happen. Things get spilled. Sometimes subsurface systems leak. And so you've got chemical in the subsurface. So we talked about the different types of chemicals. Now, are there different ways to think about the remediation?
So there's two main areas to look at for remediation. You have what's called a natural attenuation and an active remediation. And so there's several different ways to look at those. Natural attenuation, you're kind of looking for a lower level of contamination over time. And really when it disperses at a slower rate over a larger area, you're looking for the degradation of it or a dilution also on the natural attenuation.
And, you know, and those are important tools because I guess the first part is, and we'll do another podcast talk about this, is if you suspect you've got a chemical in the subsurface, you have to assess it. You have to know what area it covers. Then you have to think about your subsurface setting. What do the aquifers look like? What's the geology look like? And then you got to think about, you know, how that chemical would behave. You assess it. But then there are risk tools, too. And all of these are great podcast topics. But we're talking about remediation. So you set our stage here about, you know, what does that look like? And so let's think about active remediation. And first, let's start with the more common constituents or chemicals, if you will. Let's think about what are ways to actively remediate the lighter constituents.
So the lighter constituents like the gasoline, the diesels, motor oils, similar to those, you're going to be looking at more of a engineered system or a type of technology to treat and contain an area. Some of the ones that are more common would be a pump and treat system with a submersible pump treating, pumping back to a system that would treat and separate what was in the subsurface. Dual phase remediation, which works with an added vacuum system to also recover the soil vapor. Also, ozone sparging, where we sparge into the ground, so you're not removing anything, you're treating it in place. Excavation, it's a not quite as common, but if you have the availability to remove soil in an area that's contaminated, that's always a quicker way to be able to, but it's not always feasible. Air sparging is similar to the ozone sparging and chemical injection as well.
And, you know, and these are all very active techniques. They all have their pros and cons. But you've got to really think through, you know, the geologic setting matters, the type of chemical certainly matters, how it behaves. You've got all these great tools, but there's pros and cons to each one. You know, as a matter of fact, as you go into active remediation, you're going to have something, as you said earlier, Jared, more substantial or a higher concentration that would force you to actively remediate it. So on the other side of the light phase, if you were able to let Mother Nature, let it kind of monitor and attenuate, how do you approach that? What are some techniques there?
So on the natural attenuation, there is a continued monitoring that you can do at the facility. And we would install groundwater recovery wells and monitoring wells. And that way we could monitor this either on a quarterly, annual, or semi-annual basis. And we would look for the dispersion over the site and make sure that it wasn't migrating off site and we were able to contain it on site and look for the degradation of the COCs on site to make sure that Mother Nature was taking care of it.
Gotcha. So, and that's, you know, even on, you could actively remediate a chemical, but as the process goes on and you really get down to the more the minimal concentrations, but they're still above the state action levels, you can always go from an active remediation system to a natural attenuation, couldn't you?
That's always a possibility. You could look at that, but then also something that is a lot more common now is changing to a second technology and doing a combination. So if you do have a free phase LNAPL sitting on top of the groundwater, you have to have either a DPVE or a pump and treat to be able to treat that large volume that's in free phase. Once you get to the dissolved phase, you can then bring in an ozone sparging or an air sparging or chemical injection to really polish that off at the end to lower your concentrations.
No doubt. So you said, or we've been also talking about DNAPLs, those sink and, you know, those can go to some pretty significant depths. That really makes remediation difficult, doesn't it?
It does. DNAPLs, like I said, the time frame is always increased when you're looking at a DNAPL, and you're looking for that confining layer that will taken where the sinking stops, but the pump and treat is a good option for that, depending on what you're looking at. Ozone also is a good option because you can pump it to great depths and also treat soil and groundwater with each one of those.
So think about geologic setting, you know, with a sinker, you know, sand's going to allow it to move, you know, quicker, clay's going to confine it. But as a matter of practice, is it easier cleaned up sandy subsurfaces or easier cleaned up clay subsurfaces?
So as a rule of thumb, usually, we won't say always, but usually the sands are easier to clean up. You can move more of the groundwater. You can move more air through each pore volume in that area rather than the clay. The clay is so tight, it really restricts your movement of your technologies.
But that can also become a little bit more complicated because the sand, as you referred, is going to allow air to move, a lot more air to move through the subsurface. You're going to produce a lot more water. So you got a lot more, you know, media to deal with too.
That's right. But if it's easier to treat, that means it also disperses quicker also. So there's a pro and con to all of it. It's not a one fit all.
No doubt. So, you know, we've been talking about solvents and L-naples and D-naples. There is another area that you research, we've actually done some podcasts on, and that is kind of the latest, greatest contaminant out there. It is
PFAS.
PFAS. So let's also include that too, because as we've talked before, you know, PFAS are everywhere. There's a great benefit to our, you know, quality of life that's enjoyed off of those. But as we've learned, there are forever chemical. That's kind of another nickname for them. And as they get into the subsurface, they get really, it's a real challenge to go and remediate those. Talk to our listening audience about kind of the latest in regards to where we are with PFAS.
So PFAS, it is challenging to remediate them because they are a forever chemical. You're looking more at a pump and treat to bring the groundwater to the surface to treat it through either a carbon bed or a combination of carbon and polyresins. The problem is after you run this through that media, you're left with that media, and then it is also contaminated with the PFAS. So you have to look at a high heat incineration for the disposal of the carbon or the reactivation of the carbon and resins, but trying to get that to a certain temperature level to incinerate that, it is a problem. We do look at the high heat applications in the subsurface also through thermal remediation that is becoming more of there's a lot of technologies out there now that are applying this and a lot of companies that are doing research on. So it's every day there's something new coming up that they're testing on the PFAS for sure.
It really is the Wild West because there's so much being developed, so many things being thought of. So going back into the topic of remediation, Jared, your experience, what are the most different techniques you've ever seen used on one particular site?
So a combination on one site, we have used excavation to remove the source area to really take that initial concentration down. We then had still a spread of free product in the area, and so we brought in a DPVE system. And once the DPVE system removed the free phase product, we had a ozone that we installed, and that was able to really get the concentrations down to what we consider the groundwater one levels in Louisiana and polish it down to where we needed to receive an NFA for the site.
And then really once you completed that remediation, you went into a year of monitoring. You could also sort of call that attenuation too, because you just want to make sure nothing pops back and rebounds. That's really cool. What's your favorite go-to remediation technology, Jared?
My go-to would be a DPVE ozone combination. To me, you can treat at any level, you can treat any media, and you can get it down to the levels that you need.
A great 1-2 punch.
That's it.
Great 1-2 punch. You know, an ozone is an amazing treatment system because, you know, not only is it used for remediation of chemicals, but ozone can also be used many other applications too. So it's a really, really cool technique.
Yeah, it's definitely a wide use on the ozone, and it's not just for injection. And there's many applications you can see for ozone.
Well, man, you set the table well, and I hope our audience has enjoyed a conversation. Any other thoughts before we start to wrap up?
That's like we said before, there's not a one fit all. It's we approach each site as if it's a new day. And so we look at it, what would be best for the site and what would be the most cost effective. So,
well said. So, hey, if you're out there listening and you'd like to talk about remediation a little bit deeper, a little, no pun intended, a little more, hey, reach out to us. Jared, myself, the easiest way to find us is hop onto our website, ppmco.com. And that's Peter, Paul, Mary, Charlie, Oscar. .com, ppmco.com. You can find, I think it's under the contact us tab. You'll find our different contacts and you can email us, certainly call us. We'd love to visit with you. Hope you enjoyed it. Jared, as always, thank you for sitting in with us. You always bring a lot of great information to our audience. Much appreciated, my friend. And until our next podcast, this is Todd Perry and this is PPM Simplifies.
Thank you for finding our podcast. For more information, be sure to visit our website at ppmco.com. To stay updated on new episodes, feel free to subscribe to PPM Simplifies on your podcast app of choice. Until next time, this is PPM Simplifies.